A few weeks ago, the LA Times ran a story on something of a counterintuitive study that shows that children raised in non-religious homes are more generous and altruistic than children from observant families. This raises a question about the role religion plays in instilling morals. We might also question the role religion plays in issues making headlines these days, such as the war raging over ISIS and execution as punishment for crime. Joining us to tackle these thorny questions once again are our ethics professor. They are Wayne Vaught. He's dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences, making him one of my bosses over at UMKC. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. And Wayne, always good to have you. Welcome.
Good to be here, Steve.
Bruce Bubach is also here. He's a curator's distinguished teaching professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy. He holds a joint appointment in the School of Law. And Bruce, welcome back to you, too.
Good morning, Steve.
So morality and religion, Wayne Vaught, what's the connection? And maybe the question is, is there a connection?
Well, it is a good question. It's a question that sort of dates back throughout the history of philosophy. What's the connection at all between religious tenets and religious beliefs and moral codes? One of the challenging philosophical questions we sometimes get students to try to wrestle with is whether something is moral because a deity, whatever the religious belief might be, says that X is right or that X is wrong. Or is morality, does the deity say that X is wrong because it is, in fact, according to some independent criteria, right or wrong? And so struggling with that question is one of the, some will say, is that if you can comprehend that distinction, that that's sort of your first step to understanding that you can actually engage in sort of a philosophical debate, because it really is a tough question. The problem becomes is if morality is dependent upon the wills of a deity and the deity were to decide to say, well, you know, yesterday stealing and lying were wrong, but today, you know, I'm kind of like those things. So we're going to command that stealing and lying are now right. Would that just sort of change the moral code? And people would have difficulty thinking about war, thinking about ISIS, thinking about these things that are going on. Is a deity going to say, yeah, it's right to go into an entertainment facility, whatever, my theater, mm-hmm. and gun down all of these people because my God has now said that's right? Would that make what they're doing right? And as I say, well, there seems to be something troublesome with that. Even if you are of a religious organization where you're saying, my God is telling me that this is the right thing to do. So then the question becomes, well, could God only command things that are right because they are in fact right? So going in and killing people, innocent bystanders watching a concert, seems to be wrong wherever it might occur. Mm-hmm. And you can't imagine a situation in which God, whomever that deity would be for any individual, would say, do that, and that could be a right thing.
So still, if you have a series of different deities, as we do on this planet, that mm-hmm. begins to complicate things pretty quickly.
It could. This deity says this is right. And with the Greek gods, that was part of the problem. The gods were always fighting with each other about mm-hmm. various sorts of things. And so what was right or wrong could depend upon, you know, the whims and the various beliefs of the people who were in charge. But that raises this fundamentally ethical challenge that most of us don't want to embrace, is that it seems that whomever these gods might be, and if there are multiple of them, there seem to be certain things like raping and pillaging and killing children and doing all sorts of horrific things that we see that no religion, no God could embrace as being morally acceptable. And if that's the case, it creates this interesting quagmire where there is an independent criteria for morality that exists separate from the deities themselves. Now, one way in which that will try to be resolved would be within sort of natural law theory, and which gets into where we would get into just war theory if we're going to talk about the issue of war.
Yeah, we will.
Which is where the belief is, well, God acts according to God's nature, and we might misinterpret what God's will would be. But God can only act in accordance with God's will, and God would never command that someone go in and do something that was so horrific, not because God can't do it, because it's just not consistent with the nature of that entity or that deity.
You know, Bruce, this study that I mentioned at the opening here, which is going to raise some eyebrows, at least among some folks that are listening right now, I should point out it appears to be a credible study. It was published in the journal Current Biology, and the research team was led by a University of Chicago neuroscientist. It's going to have a lot of parents, you know, both churchgoers and non-churchgoers, scratching their heads. What do you make of it?
I was puzzled by the results initially. Mm-hmm. And I should say at the outset, I don't have a dog in this fight. but I did see the results and I thought, now, wait a minute. I remember the social capital community survey that was done in 2000 of 30,000 people that determined that religious adults are far more generous than non-religious adults.
Just the opposite of what this study found.
Yeah. So we're dealing with children sharing stickers. And there's a broad range of religions represented. As I recall from the study, 43% of the children talked to were Muslim, about 25% were Christian. I'm not sure what conclusions to draw from this study. I'm fairly certain you cannot conclude that there is any sort of difference between people who are raised in a religious home as opposed to people who are not raised in a religious home. On the other hand—
Although the authors beg to disagree.
Yeah, they do. I suspect that the factors in raising a moral child, a child who is sympathetic to others, are far more set by the parents, whether they're religious or not, and the way in which they behave and the way in which they relate to other people. Children watch adults, and if the behavior of the parents is a result of religious training, fine. If the behavior of the parents rather is as a result of some ethical standards that they embrace, that would seem to make a bigger difference. There clearly is, and Wayne mentioned a few moments ago, there clearly is a historical distinction between what religions say is right and wrong and what we recognize as right and wrong. The Greeks, who I think will emerge again later on in our conversation, in one of the Platonic dialogues where Socrates is talking to a guy named Euthyphro, and he asks the question, do the gods love it because it's pious, or is it pious because the gods love it? One of my students last year said, that sounds like who's on first. And I said, no, here's the point. And the point is exactly the one that Wayne raised. So this has been an ongoing, for thousands of years, it's been an ongoing discussion.
That's interesting.
I do think that a huge mistake is to say you can only be moral if you're religious. Mm-hmm. That's simply not true.
Although there is a sense in our culture, Bruce, that a lot of people do look at it that way, that if you're not raised in the church or whatever church that is, that there's something of a mark against you out
there. This is true. Yes, there's no question about that. And for many people, that could well be the path toward recognizing what's right and wrong, what ought to be done, what ought not to be done. But I do think that the important point is not a necessary condition.
Yeah.
And in fact, as Wayne suggested, there could be some religious practices that lead in exactly a different direction.
Let me get our listeners engaged here. How should parents encourage altruistic behavior in their kids? And what do you make of the findings of this study, which suggests that church-going kids aren't as generous as those who stay home on Sundays? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Wayne Vaught, what's your sense here? What's your theory? Why would a kid raised in a non-religious home tend to be more generous than kids who've been going to church all their lives? Do you have any sense of that?
You know, it probably does. I think Bruce is right. It comes down to behaviors and practices, and what one would have to look at. And I think what the study was trying to see is, are there certain types of engagement practices that one sees by those practicing a religious belief and those who are not?
Yeah.
So is there sort of a— are they, as because they think, well, we go to church, we don't have to talk about these issues as much. And so if you're in a non-religious home or environment, maybe that this tends to be more of a topic of a conversation, more of a sense of internal responsibility for one's moral actions versus the idea of, you know, there are all kinds of, I think, explanations that could give rise to why is it in this particular study that there was a statistically significant difference between those children who were in a purportedly religious environment and not. But the other thing I think that you would have to look at is the difference between going to church and being religious. And I think some of our callers will certainly make a distinction between those two things. If I'm not an affiliate of a particular church, I could still see myself, whether it be by nature or whatever my spiritual home or spirituality might be, it might not be associated with a particular religious affiliation, but it's very deeply centered on the way in which I make decisions. And that is probably something that, that goes much more back to the way the families are being raised. And so I would suspect if the, if that study were teased out anymore, you would probably find some aspects of spirituality that may be more present because the families feel they have to create that versus the church giving this artificial sense of it versus those in the church, many of whom may be very spiritual as well, are kind of release themselves to the edifices of the institution and don't embrace it as deeply as those and not. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what would cause that.
Bruce, I'm going to go back to the cultural implications here, and I'm wondering if we're on the brink of some new thinking in our society about all this stuff. I mean, this country, as of today, I think I'm accurate in saying, wouldn't dream of electing an atheist president, for example. And again, as I mentioned before, there's this idea that individuals who aren't religious are sometimes considered to be morally suspect. Is all this, is this study going to begin to change that thinking, or is that thinking changing anyway out there?
I don't think the study will change it, but I do think that the thinking is changing. Mm-hmm. And the idea, consider the various communions there are, even within the Kansas City area, that are not part of a major national religion.
Mm-hmm.
They're independent, and yet they're spiritual, and they do good works. I think that is a move away from a kind of lockstep religious experience towards something that's a little bit freer, a little bit more reflective of the way in which the society is moving. Is it moving toward being a more secular society? I don't know, but I think you are right. An atheist could not be elected president.
Yeah.
And I do think that, although I, to my mind, one of the more unfortunate things that's happened in our national campaigns, especially for the president, has been the emergence of a discussion of religion.
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution forbids a religious test for a for a position of public trust.
Yeah.
It just forbids it. And here we have people being asked about their religious views.
Yeah.
And I think that's a mistake. That's exactly the wrong direction.
Well, Wayne, let's go back to the trillion-dollar question here, which it strikes me as this. I mean, is religion vital or even essential for moral development? This study suggests the answer is probably no.
And I would agree with the study that I don't think that it is. It's not a necessary condition. And to Bruce's point, I'll just challenge this. I do think an atheist could be elected president, but not one who's not affiliated with a particular religious church. So,
a closet atheist.
So, exactly right.
Well, okay.
I mean, there are people who are, but
it could be lots of closet
things. To make that distinction. But that kind of goes back to the point I was making earlier, just about you don't know what someone's spiritual connection is or what one's actual internal motivation is. And I think that that really is relevant. And just being part of a church isn't doing that. But no, I come back to the million-dollar question. I think it's very clear that one can be, and many, in fact, atheists are very morally upstanding people and have developed a code, a character traits, and a code of ethics that is of great repute and contrary to, I mean, the thing is, you see so many people, we could go through the list and name the recent examples of, well, you know, this guy that was on the TV show who then was found to have molested his sisters and then was on Ashley Madison and now most recently is being sued by a former porn star whom he had sexual relationships with and was holding himself up as a person of high moral standard and religious belief. You get continued examples of that, which I'm saying that I'm part of a religious organization, but my morality seems to be somewhat corrupt. And then you have people who are not part of churches, and you would think this is exactly the type of person I would want to be associated with, and they're quite morally upstanding people. So there's clearly no absolute necessary connection between religion, I think, and morality.
It is a wonderful example of hypocrisy.
Absolutely.
And, of course, La Rochefoucauld once said, what, hypocrisy is the honor that vice pays to virtue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Say that again.
Hypocrisy is the honor that vice pays to virtue.
Yeah.
and that's a perfect example.
Exactly.
Those are those lines that big time professors toss around. It's hard for me mortals to hang around with. The connection between religion and morality is our topic. 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Eric from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Yes, I was just listening and heard what you were talking about, and it made me think of how as a child I remember going to church, and in Sunday school it was more of a teaching of morality, ethics, things like that. As I got older, it seemed like the message became more politicized, and we started hearing more about the culture wars. And then as a young adult, I eventually left the church, and I was kind of wondering if maybe that would lead to results as we're, hearing them, that it's not so much morals being taught in Sunday school or, to children, but more of a political message.
Gentlemen, anybody?
I don't know. I don't go to Sunday school. I've taught Sunday school a couple of times, but it has really been about the medieval philosophers. I avoided politics.
And I think we couldn't sit and make any generalization about it. I imagine it depends on the church and the type of church and the people involved. And some of them, I'm sure, are incredibly well devoted to kind of deep scriptural analysis and hermeneutics and trying to figure out these things. And others probably do tend to be more on the political activist sort of side.
Yeah.
So you're going to find, I think, just a hodgepodge of different experiences. And it's what always makes it difficult to talk about religion in these broad sweeping terms, is because it means so much, even, from church to church and individual to individual.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Eric, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. So if all this is the case, there's not this connection between religion and morality. Bruce, does that begin to undermine the foundational strength of organized religion in any way or not?
Well, I think the best thing that's happened to organized religion historically, which unfortunately recently is being reversed, is getting out of politics.
Mm-hmm.
After the 30 Years' War, and the Treaty of Westphalia essentially said, look, the sovereign states determine what goes on within the states, not the Pope, not mm-hmm. the Holy Roman Emperor. And that was a positive move. But to see religion beginning to seep back into political matters, I think, is really retrograde. It's really moving in the wrong direction. I would hope that someone would come along in national public life and say, this is a mistake, that we really have to separate religion and religious practice from our political views, because we should.
Let's get one more great view here. Rabbi Mark Levin from Prairie Village is calling in. Rabbi, always nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you.
All's well. Yeah. So I'm fascinated by this discussion, the equation between supposed equation between religion and morality. That's certainly not my experience, but it has much more to do. And I should say, for those who maybe don't know me, I was a pulpit rabbi for like 40 years. My experience is not the religious teaching is the predominant influence on people's morality. Much more a discussion of the kind of environment in which they're raised. Maybe a certain amount of ritual, maybe social grouping, but not morality.
Wayne Vaught?
Yeah, I think that sort of harks back. I agree with him totally, to what Bruce was saying at the outset, that what you're really looking at is the way people are raised, the home environment in which they encounter, the habits. And this goes back to this Aristotelian idea, which I think is absolutely right, is that morality is taught by example and by habit. And as a matter of fact, the word morals comes from the Greek word that means custom or habit.
Hmm.
And so what you're talking about when you're talking about morality is you're talking about the customs, the practices, the habits that are habitualized and learned in an environment, in a social situation, as the rabbi, I think, is absolutely correctly identified,
mm-hmm.
and that you internalize those practices and habits, and they become what we call, you don't even think about them. They become so habitual. Ritualized behaviors that you act morally, not because you think about, should I steal a thing of gum when I go into the store? I mean, I hope most people don't have to go through that decision-making process every time they encounter something. It's just a habit.
Yeah.
You just go in, you pay for it, you don't even think about it. And it's because of years and years of training and practice. And Aristotle felt you couldn't actually talk about morality until you were much, much older.
The Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius has a really great line. He says, being good should be like a grapevine the grapevine doesn't think I'm going to produce grapes. It just produces grapes.
Ah,
and if you're a good person, you're just good.
Yeah.
You don't think I'm going to be good today.
Yeah. Rabbi, anything else about how Bruce and Wayne are doing here you want to comment on?
Very briefly, I want to say two things. One is people join religious groups because of their beliefs, not the other way around. I mean, it goes the other way as well, but think about it. If somebody thinks, as we see people today, you know, who want to say, well, so-and-so deserves to die. So they join a religious group that says the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So just because you have a particular morality doesn't mean that you're going to be in a group that the rest of us think is going to be moral. You're just going to join a group that says the same kind of thing that you said.
Right, right.
And the other thing is that the human ability for hypocrisy, and I would say that today we're in an era in which hypocrisy has no penalty. And the human ability to rationalize it, I see all the time, and to act hypocritically is infinite. And so, you know, you could be in a group except for it doesn't apply to me, or it doesn't apply to me in this circumstance.
You're talking to a guy who covers politics, Mark, so you're speaking a lot of great truth there, and I appreciate that.
You never heard this before, right?
You never heard this before, absolutely. Rabbi Mark Levin, always appreciate it. Thanks for the good call.
Okay. Good to talk to you.
And the rabbi does mention raise an interesting question. We talk about ethics in organizations. Well, the Mau-Mau had ethics. The mafia has ethics.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean they're all positive.
That's a great point.
Right.
Let's do this. Let's take a break, gentlemen. When we come back, we're going to sort of switch this conversation a little bit and talk about how all of this applies to war, how all of this applies to capital punishment, and all kinds of thorny questions. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can find our discussion on child sex trafficking in America and learn the real reasons behind the MU Chancellor's resignation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the true story of two soldiers who returned from the Middle East and the organizations they founded that give renewed purpose to other veterans. And we'll have your weekend to-do list with Brian McTavish. This hour, we're visiting with our ethics professors. They are Wayne Vaught, the Dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. Bruce Bubach is Curator's Distinguished Teaching Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy, also at UMKC. Gentlemen, in our first half, we were talking about this tie between morality and religion and this study that came out that raised questions about the ties between religion and ethical behavior. The study also found that Muslim children perceived violent acts with more disdain than other children, but then suggested worse punishments than the others. And I'm wondering, Bruce, what's the implication of that finding when it comes to big issues around the world these days? I'm thinking about ISIS and all kinds of things.
It's a very interesting question because this is a different world, but it's an old world.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the theory of just war in the past, and there is a respectable sequence of writers, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, a guy named Hugo Grotius, who wrote about what makes a war a just war. I don't think that applies to ISIS. I don't think that this theory is one that's appropriately applied to ISIS. Let me read the first line from a book I do think applies to ISIS. Rage goddess, sing the rage of Peleus' son Achilles. I think the Iliad is a better measure of what we're dealing with here than any sort of Western theory about war.
And let me
say why.
Yeah.
The ancient Greeks, we valorize the Greeks, but we don't step back and say, what did they value? Well, they clearly valued Homer. What does Homer talk about? And particularly he talks about the war in Troy. The Iliad, especially, is one that accounts for the war in Troy. And then the Odyssey is what happens afterwards. But if you read the Iliad, and I always recommend once you're finished with school, read it because it's a lot more fun to read it when you're not required to. You find out how incredibly bloody it is.
Hmm.
I mean, the Trojan War was a bloody affair. The story itself is filled with beheadings and rape and slashings and thousands being killed. And then you say, wait a minute, the Greeks really honored this stuff. They thought of guys like Achilles as being heroes. They were looking to the past. So here's what I think the connection is to ISIS. The Greeks looked to the past, and for the Greeks, kinship was critical. And you see that in the Homeric writings. Even during the time that we tend to think it was a wonderful time of the emergence of philosophy and so on, they were still looking to the heroes. Now, what were the heroes? Well, Achilles, of course, is widely regarded as the greatest of the heroes. Carolyn Alexander has just published a new translation of the Iliad. And she was asked in an interview, what'd you think of Brad Pitt in Troy? And she said, well, he certainly was athletic, and there was a lot of really interesting sword play, but he was not Achilles. And then she said something that just made me pause. She said, meeting Achilles was more like meeting a tiger than it was like meeting a fancy swordsman, someone who's just going to kill you. They're not going to go through all kinds of fancy stuff. Okay, well, the people in ISIS, the guys in ISIS are stone-cold killers. And what do they value? Kinship and the past. We look toward the future. They look toward the past. I think that's a better path toward understanding what we're dealing with here than if we were to look at St. Augustine, who initially says a just war must be made by a justly established sovereign. Well, that's not a justly established sovereign. That's what I said earlier. We're going to look back at the Greeks a couple of times, right? And I do think that this is something that's worth looking at.
You know, Wayne Vaught, the Obama administration these days is saying that we're back at war, you know, this time with ISIS, obviously, in the wake of the Paris attacks. Many of the world's religions urge followers not to kill. Does religion ever justify killing in a time of war? What's your sense of that?
Well, it does, and I think that the history of just war theory that Bruce
That's
has mentioned
is
an attempt to reconcile these disparate views that you have. On the one hand, one of the top 10 commandments, thou shalt not kill, combined with the obligation, of protecting oneself, one's family, of being put in situations where killing now becomes necessary. And how do those things become rectified? Not only in pronouncing war, but actually in the conduct of war itself. And so we do find in times of war that there are certain circumstances in which you can justly kill someone. So in self-defense, just kind of outside the context of war, that seems to be something that I think we would all say, and most religious writers, I believe, would say, you're about to be killed, and you have the opportunity, and the only way to defend yourself is to kill your attacker. You would be morally justified in doing so.
Although not everybody agrees with that.
I would think that, yeah, there clearly could be interpretations where, even in that context, killing would be morally wrong. And so I guess you could pull from various different sort of scriptural passages or whatever to justify what I think one would take as an extremist view, that even killing in self-defense is morally inappropriate.
Yeah.
But within religious context, there is, if you shift a little bit away from that, there's certainly a very strong tradition of belief that in certain circumstances, killing is morally justified, and the need for self-defense or the need to stop horrific acts. So if it's not sort of myself being attacked, but now another nation is attacking, we see genocide around the world, we see ISIS doing what they are doing, not as a sovereign nation per se, but sort of as these, as Bruce says, these individual thug attacker types. What now is the legitimate response for a sovereign state to that threat? And in that situation, you have a case where justification can be made because there is a real identifiable harm, something that is horrifically that's happening. There are no more effective ways of curtailing it. And so just war theory does have a series of criteria that would have to be met in order for the engagement to be morally justified. So you would have to show that, one, there is a just cause, that there is a cause that in which you're engaging in the act that's morally justified itself, and preventing someone from being killed is a just cause, that there aren't other diplomatic methods of solving the problem. So you don't just go in and engage in war and kill other people just because it's the easiest thing to do or just because it's the quickest thing to do. There might be other legitimate ways in which that harm can be mitigated without engaging in war. And if that's the case, then just war is not merited. And there has to be some belief that there would be success in the engagement. So if you're just going to go out and, you know, drop nuclear weapons or do whatever you might do, and you knew that, well, you're going to kill a lot of people, but it's not going to do anything to stop the Islamic State, then you're not justified engaging in those particular acts. And so that's what makes this is particularly challenging, especially in the case of ISIS, because it's so scattered and so difficult to know when am I engaging in a situation that's actually going to mitigate the harm, and is engagement in war actually going to do that in this case?
The origins of the just war theory, you hear that theory kicked around a lot, is what, gentlemen? Do any sense of that?
Well, as a theory, it's with St. Augustine. And St. Augustine—
Remind us who he was,
St. Augustine was a bishop in Hippo, which was in what was modern-day Algeria, a town called Souk Ahras. Augustine himself was trained as a lawyer. He's a really interesting guy. His mother, Saint Monica, prayed for his conversion to Christianity. He didn't become a Christian until adulthood. And in his confessions, which are fun to read, he says when he was talking about converting, he said, "My prayer at that time was, God, grant me chastity and continence, but not yet." He had a lot of fun, apparently. Mm-hmm. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas are considered to be the two premier Catholic philosophers of the Middle Ages, and they both have something to say about just war. Aquinas takes over from Augustine. First of all, as I mentioned a while ago, it has to be a sovereign state that engages in the just war. So there is a real question about ISIS, whether that would apply to them. Secondly, there has to be, as Wayne was just suggesting, there has to be some goal which is seen as being a response to an external threat. Well, it's not unusual to see Western ideas as a response, as an external threat, and to see this sort of action as
clearly
a response.
In present-day situations,
right.
That applies.
Yeah. And there also has to be one other element, which I'm sure is absent here, and that is the goal has to be a return to peace. That has to be what you move toward. And both Augustine and Aquinas write about this in a way that indicates that they have thought through what war involves. And as Wayne suggested, the analysis of the commandment against killing really becomes an analysis of against murdering, that it is justified to kill in self-defense. There are some religious traditions that are pacifist, but not many.
Right.
To what extent were these ideas controversial when they were first promulgated back in the day?
They were controversial, but I think more in a sense of generated by some horrific events that occurred. Mm-hmm. They're really reactive to the way in which war was fought. I mentioned Hugo Grotius, who writes after the Thirty Years' War. And the Thirty Years' War was initially this horrible religious war in Europe that slaughtered tens of thousands of people just because of their community, just because of the religion that they belonged to. And at the end of it, the slaughter was aimed at civilians. It was no longer just one army against another, but it was people, ordinary civilians, innocent civilians practicing the religion that I don't like, and we're going to kill them. That naturally leads to jurists like Grotius saying, "Hey, wait a minute, what can we do here?" And he introduced the idea of treaties. He introduced the idea of the respect of the individual princes, that the sovereignty of the state must be respected. He introduced the idea of religious freedom within the state that cannot be imposed from the outside. So it was really reactive to some horrific circumstances. Now, if we go forward to the 1940s, what do we see on the Eastern Front in Europe in World War II? It was horrific. Any circumstance in which the soldiers on both sides are fighting against being placed on Red Cross trains because they know the other guys are going to attack the Red Cross trains is a barbaric circumstance. So I don't see anything coming as a result of that, though.
We're talking about just war theory. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. And again, you can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. So if a member of ISIS was sitting here at our table today, Wayne, and by all means, I'm glad that that member is not here today, but that person would be so convinced that they are what is happening in Paris and elsewhere is in the name of goodness, in the name of the spirit in which the religion they believe, the doctrines that they have been imbued with, and you would say what to them?
You mean in terms of the response to that,
yes,
that belief?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, this is where you would try to challenge and get engage in a conversation. But when you have these extremist views, and whether it's Muslim, whether it's Christian, I mean, you encounter.
Ask belief earlier. For them is not extremist. It is simply
it's part of their life, and it's part of the way that they perceive the world and their ideologies, and they think that they're acting in the right. And this is where it gets back to, well, what is the value of religious import here? And I think that many would say, well, they have so completely failed to understand the religious ideologies of the very religion that they are professing, just like we would in the United States, where you encounter the sort of same sort of extremist within certain Christian sects, and you say, well, they're acting, whether it be shootings at Planned Parenthood facilities or wherever, where they're saying, I'm a devout religious person, and I'm doing this because God has commanded me to come and take out these murdering abortionists. You encounter these situations where you would want to ask them, well, let's take some steps back and think about what the principles are that you are espousing, and is what you're saying even internally self-consistent in a way that makes sense? And and that's what philosophy tries to do, is to try to push people, even, you know, people, students that will come in any class, we try to push them off their comfort level, whatever it might be, whatever religious or moral or cultural beliefs they hold. We like to kind of push them off a little bit, and so let's sort of think about what's underlying and underpinning the beliefs you have. And one would hope that you would then get this person to realize, wait, there's some real inconsistencies in what I'm holding here. But with that extremist mentality, I doubt you'd have a lot of success.
Let me go back to some phone calls here. As we talked about just war theory with all the developments with ISIS around the globe, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. George from Meriden, Kansas, who's a Roman Catholic priest. George, good morning.
Good morning. Great show. I think Catholic moralists today are hardly defending the just war theory. I think in summary, they're saying all wars are immoral, but some may be necessary.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting distinction you're making there, George, right?
It is.
Go ahead, George. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they've actually said that in different ways this morning. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, I and he might elaborate. Do you feel that this, I mean, there's a principle of double effect that's often been part of Catholic theologies in dealing with a lot of challenges, where there's a foreseen but unintended consequence, and sometimes war might be one of these categories of things that has to be done. There's an evil, but it's a justifiable evil under some circumstances. And he might actually be curious to see what his response is to that. Is that a component of modern Catholic thought?
I believe so. Yes, but one of the things that you mentioned earlier. It has to lead back to peace, and it has to be a legitimate government doing it, yes.
And that's absolutely right. I mean, for just war theory, the end, the goal always has to be the restoration of peace and harmony. Mm-hmm. That's the ultimate goal.
I'm glad you called, George. Thanks very much.
You bet. Good program. Go for it.
Thank you, George. Bruce Bubach, you know, sort of wrap up this notion of just war for a moment. So essentially where we're coming down here is that we're saying our killing of members of ISIS can be justified, but their killing of us is not.
I suspect that is the argument that we would make.
Yeah.
Yes. Although Father George does raise an interesting question, which is just war, certainly among Catholic theologians, is just war theory still something to be embraced, or is it simply a matter of necessity? I would think that a question of consistency would be an important one in evaluating what our actions ought to be. The response of the United States to what's happening with ISIS, I think, is one that is it has to be done very carefully. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a trivial thing to say. It has to be done carefully. But this is potentially quite dangerous. Mm-hmm. What is happening is quite dangerous. And I do think, and one of the reasons I wanted to bring in the Iliad is, I think that part of it, there's some misunderstanding. There's a misunderstanding of what we're dealing with in the sense that these are tigers. They're probably not highly skilled, and a trained Western army could probably deal with them quite quickly. But there's a second issue that I think we have often failed to recognize when we talk about Islam as a religion. We draw, I believe, that we, especially people who are Christians, draw a distinction between their religious views, their education, their business practices, their families, their communities, and so on. Under Islam, that's a continuity. It's one thing. Mm-hmm. And if we try to say, look, we want to separate out this little piece from the Muslim world and deal with that, it isn't going to work. It has to be one that is. It has to be dealt with as a continuous,
holistically.
Holistically. Mm-hmm. That's a perfect word for it.
Yeah.
And I do think that has to be part of whatever it is that we want to do. But ISIS has demonstrated, I think, they're very dangerous, and I do not doubt for a moment that it may not be as horrific as Paris, but something like this will happen in the United States.
Hmm. Let's go to the third leg of our stool today, just to wrap up our conversation. We're talking about thou shalt not kill. We've gone over that, and we've also talked about how this applies to war and the battle against ISIS. So, Wayne Vaught, what about another hot issue here, capital punishment? How does thou shalt not kill square with America's death penalty, which has been employed now for any number of years?
Right. Well, it does raise, I think, some interesting challenges, again, for those who would hold a very strong position on the ethics of killing and that it is always wrong. And this isn't obviously a just war example, but you would think some of the same characteristics about when is it appropriate to kill would come to play here. And executions, I don't want to get into a personal decision, but I think there are compelling ethical arguments that favor and justify capital punishment in many circumstances. But if you're looking at it from this sort of religious perspective, I mean, there are a few of the elements that are missing, killing is justified because there is a foreseen harm that you're trying to stop. Well, the problem with these people is they're incarcerated. I mean, you've mm-hmm. already taken them out of society. You've eliminated the risk and threat. There are certainly less harmful ways of dealing with that. You imprison them forever versus killing them. So if you were thinking about, well, how does a person of a particular religious belief, particularly, again, one who's identified just war theory is a justification for killing. Does this in some way, in any meaningful way, apply to when can we justifiably kill someone in our society, mm-hmm. particularly through capital punishment? It seems that there are some missing elements there. So you have to have some different sort of analysis or ethical argument. And Kant had one, which Kant felt clearly that executions were and capital punishment was justified because, according to Kant, there are certain types of acts for which execution was the justified consequent of that act. Mm-hmm. And as people, as moral people, you had an obligation to the moral law, the greater moral law, to ensure that just acts were carried out. And since capital punishment was the just punishment for certain types of acts, we actually have moral obligations to carry those out in certain circumstances and kill people. But it's not from a religious argument or religious belief system. And I think you have a bit more of a challenge.
We're going to have to leave our conversation right there. I want to thank our ethics professors today, Wayne Vaught, the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences, Bruce Bubach, a curator's distinguished teaching professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy, also at UMKC. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having us.
This was very good.